Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Isn't this fine, lovely stroll on the moors?
Did you hear that?
I heard that.
What is it?
You think it's a dog?
Nice doggy. Good boy.
On his first trip to Paris, Andy McDermott is looking for a little danger.
Andy, what are you doing?
I'll show you guys a stunt you'll never top.
But tonight...
Andy, this is madness. You're gonna get yourself killed.
There's nothing more dangerous than falling for the wrong girl.
No, don't!
Hello, and welcome to Rewatchability. We are a podcast on the Entertainment One Podcast Network. I'm Robert LaRonde. With me, as always, is...
Jam McNabb.
And, hey...
I don't know why I said it like that.
It was spooky. I mean, it's what I think the millennials are calling spooky season. So, That was a spooky voice. It's very apropos.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. And we have a spooky movie. We have one spooky movie and one, you know, terribly, terribly awful-looking movie.
Oh, boy.
But before we get into that, first of all, we want to thank the Patreons. Those are the people who give us a little bit of money each month, $1, $3, $5, however much you want, really. And that helps us keep the podcast going. And in return, we give you bonus episodes and the podcast early and ad-free and all of that stuff. So if you want to become a Patreon, please go to patreon.com/rewatchability. Now, Patreons, you may have noticed that we've been a little bit absent recently. Unfortunately, you know, we do
the podcast. Went out to get a pack of cigarettes and just didn't come back for a while.
Yeah. But it's back, baby, and we can make things work. No, I mean, we did have to take most of October off because we just couldn't make it work. And so, Patreons, we want you to know that we've been thinking of you. We appreciate your support. We are going to pause your donations for the month of November. So, you know, that way you're not not getting something for your money. And then we'll resume it the next month and it'll all be good. We're sorry that, you know, we couldn't record the podcast for a couple of weeks. It's just, you know, things come up, right?
Yeah, this was not a planned interruption, but things are crazy for all of us right now, and we just weren't able to get it together. And we looked into it, and yeah, we couldn't refund Patreon money, or if we can, it's complicated. So we will pause it for the month of November, deliver a regular amount of shows, and still send all of the Patreon donors the same, the early episodes and any bonus content that gets recorded.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be like, yeah, it'll be like a regular month for Patreons, but no one will be charged.
But, you know,
because we feel bad that, and I feel bad because it's also, I love doing horror stuff in October. It's my favorite time of year for watching, like you said, spooky movies. So it is disappointing that we didn't get to do. I mean, the only other movie we did in October was Magnolia.
Scary film.
But we, thankfully, you and I were able to get together, and we're just going to get in under the wire before before Halloween ends. Like,
it's
this
a Halloween miracle.
This will probably go up like on Halloween, right?
Yeah, if I can make it work, I might have to. Like,
yeah, boil some coffee.
I was going to say boil some witch's brew. You know, okay. I might have to get some sort of satanic intervention to get this all edited.
But yeah, we just wanted to say to all the donors, we haven't forgotten about you. We are sorry that this month didn't come together the way we'd hope, but you know, these things happen. And,
yeah,
and we'll try to make it up to you next year, next month. Good Lord, I'm tired. And we watched two goddamn movies for this week. Holy
That's right.
Shit.
We're sort of like making it up for you because, first of all, yeah, we watched two movies this week. And then also the last episode on Magnolia was like three episodes long. So, you know,
it
you
was
have
the...
enough to listen to.
It was like 2.5 hours of like us spouting our opinions. And I can't believe that I talked at such length calling someone else like self-involved and like talking about how Paul Thomas Anderson just wouldn't cut anything out.
Yeah. But,
you know, I mean, you can't watch Magnolia while you do the dishes. So, you know, that's where long podcasts come in handy, I guess.
That's right. That's right. Okay. So today we have two movies for you, of equal value. We'll discuss that. The first is it's American Werewolves in London and Paris, right? American Werewolf in London, is it 1981 John Landis film, and the sequel, An American Werewolf in Paris, which 1997? I should have.
I think it's six, isn't it? 96?
1996. No, it's 1997. Hey, I was right.
Okay. You're right.
Yeah, there you go. And yeah, it is, you know, American Werewolf in London is a beloved movie. American Werewolf in Paris, I don't think anybody has talked about since 1997. So it was a perfect opportunity to talk about both of these films. Now, JM, when was the first time that you saw American Werewolf in London, and when was the first time you saw American Werewolf in Paris? Did you see American Werewolf in London in London? American Werewolf in Paris in Paris?
No, I wish. You know, the last time I was in London, they were having, this is like 5 years ago, but they were having, it was around Halloween time, it was around this time of year.
Ooh.
And I think on Halloween night they were having a screening of An American Werewolf in London at the London Zoo at the wolf cages where David wakes up.
That would have been awesome.
And I really wanted to go, but I think I was leaving just before Halloween. Yeah, I saw An American Werewolf in London, I think I was in like grade six or something, and it was a huge movie for me at the time, and still, it's one of my favorite movies. I think it was the first like real horror movie, or it was the first movie I think I rented as a kid, like from the horror section.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I,
were you afraid
they
weren't
like,
going to rent it to you? This is rated R.
No, I was with my dad. Actually, my dad was the one who recommended it to me because, like, I was kind of, you know, dipping my toe into horror for the first time. And I remember him being like, oh, yeah, I saw this movie in the 80s. Like, it's actually really funny. Like, it's more of a comedy. I was like, okay. And I think I was renting movies to bring to, like, a sleepover with some friends around Halloween time.
You traumatized those children.
No, we all loved it. I don't know. There was just something about it that, like, it was that perfect, like, gateway horror movie that, like, it's the characters are so real and relatable, and it does have this, like, sense of humor that draws you in. And it, like, it is scary, but it's not, like, you know, it's not... You know, it didn't traumatize anybody, so I loved it, and it was, you know, I soon after that I bought a copy on VHS. It became one of those movies I would watch every so often. And no, I loved it. And I remember when Paris was coming out, I didn't know it was happening. And I remember going to see a different movie in the theater, and the like teaser trailer for Paris came on first. And it was, I think it was just that shot where like the CGI werewolf it bursts through the doorway of like a Parisian tomb.
Right.
And it was like, you don't see any footage from the movie, you just kind of see that. And then it's like an American werewolf in Paris. And, you know, being a huge fan of the first movie, I was like, oh my God, like, I can't even believe this is happening. I was so excited. Not knowing that this had, you know,
this was
no
your Christmas.
But I, you know, I just thought like, oh, you know, it's going to be
David's back.
Yeah, or something. I don't know. I thought it would be, or at least, you know, the same creative team, something.
Right.
And then when I found out that that wasn't the case and that it was supposed to be terrible, I didn't see it in the theater. And I think I...
Whoa. You see everything in the theater.
I know. I think I rented it or something, and I did not like it at all.
Wow. That's disappointing.
What about you?
Okay, well, here comes the confession. I had never seen an American Werewolf in London. I somehow missed it. I mean, it was hard to watch movies that were overtly horror-ish in my house because my mom did not like movies like that. And so it was difficult to watch. And we only had one TV for most of my life growing up. It wasn't.
You had that pentagram on the wall to
That's
ward
right.
off.
Well, it works.
Just gather around that on weeknights.
It's entertaining. But I did see an American Werewolf in Paris.
No.
Yeah. I think it was on the Movie Network. Because I also remember, I think, like the infamous bungee jump scene was like a big part. Like maybe it was cut into one of its promotional things. Because I remember seeing that scene over and over again. But
yeah, I remember that being like highlighted in the trailer and the advertising. That was like the big selling point of a werewolf movie. Was this like
what are teens into? Bungee jumping?
No, totally.
Put it in.
We're gonna have a lot of scenes where the werewolf characters are listening to Green Day and doing devil sticks. Were they still doing that in 1997? I think they were.
Yeah, and I don't, you know, I thought it was okay. It didn't, like, stick with me. It was, you know, it was very much of that sort of era of teen horror remakes, you know? I mean, except, like, really, really bad. You know, it had, like, it had teens, I mean, people who looked like they were on Dawson's Creek. It had, like, hard alternative music all over the place, and So I thought it was okay. I honestly hadn't thought about it very often, though. Every once in a while, when there's a full moon, I'm like, I wonder if American Werewolf in Paris was any good. But I mean, it's pretty much universally reviled. But that only made me more intent to go back and watch it. So I'm very glad that we finally did that. So that
the curse
is lifted.
It's my second favorite movie where a young American meets Julie Delpy in Paris and hangs around with her for a while.
Mm, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, man, can you imagine if that's how Before Sunset started, or Before Sunrise started, if it was just like a freak bungee encounter?
Well, I think it'd be like hilarious if Julie Delpy's character in the Before Sunrise movies was like the werewolf, right? Like, imagine she's on the train and, you know, Ethan Hawke scopes her out and she's just like wiping some blood off her lip or something.
I think
he leaves it ambiguous. That could totally be part of it.
I mean, you never see those characters on a night with a full moon.
That's right.
So it's possible.
That's right.
Well, do you want to do the rundowns of, I guess, both movies?
Oh, wow. Yeah. It's going to be a lot. I'm going to need wolf-like speed.
Are they fast? In the first movie, they're pretty slow.
Yeah, well, it's like a guy on a with a wheelbarrow. It's not, you know, animatronics are not fast. I mean, but okay, I'll do what I can. So, American Werewolf in London first. Let's start with London. This is the grand tour, baby. It stars Griffin Dunne and David McNaughton. That's his name, right?
I think it's just David Naughton.
Okay, David Naughton and Griffin Dunne. And they are these two American tourists, and they're walking around the moors of England. And Griffin Dunne, he isn't too happy to be there, but that's where his friend David wanted to go. But it's not very pleasant compared to some other vacation locales. It's dark, it's misty, it's raining. They have to get rides with trucks full of sheep. It's, I mean, it's not ideal. But so they find themselves, you know, way out in the middle of England, and they sort of stop because they're freezing cold at this pub. And the pub has a strange sort of name. It's called The Slaughtered Lamb, which, yeah, I mean, you know, I drink there. I mean, I drink anywhere. But they go
in. You know, it is funny, like, when it seems so, like, idiosyncratic in this movie, but then when you go to England, it's like, yeah, there is, like, a Slaughtered Lamb-like pub. There's, like, eight of those in every town in England.
Yeah, yeah. I thought, yeah, that's what they're all called.
With equally horrific names.
And they're all, I think, probably exactly the same. You go in, everybody stops and stares at you like you're like it's a Western movie or something, and then they just, you know, wait for you to leave, I would assume.
Well, I've had that happen, like, so often. I mean, I guess it's like it's kind of like a cliche, and that's partly what the movie's playing off of. But, like, this movie does capture, like, a lot of just, like, that palpable feeling of, like, being an outsider.
Yeah,
and never more so than in this opening scene where they come into the pub.
Look at that.
Yeah, what about it?
It's a five-pointed star.
Well, maybe the owners are from Texas.
Remember the Alamo.
I beg your pardon?
Oh, he was just joking.
Joking? I remember the Alamo. I saw it once in London, in Leicester Square.
She means in the cinema. That film with John Wayne.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Checkmate.
Right, with Lawrence Harvey, and everybody dies in it. Very bloody.
Bloody awful, if you ask me.
Yeah. Yeah, and these, you know, these provincial British types, they are, you know, they're not having any of what these guys are serving. They try to make, like, a little Alamo joke. It does not go anywhere. I mean, and then they hear some jokes of their own. But eventually, these guys sort of get turned out into the night. And the people at the pub, they're sort of debating whether or not they should let these guys go, you know, or whether they should let them stay. And finally, they let them go. But they tell them, you know, stick to the roads, don't go on the moors. And so they do not listen to them because they're Americans. And they wander. sorry, Americans.
They invade and colonize the moors.
That's right. Well, yeah, they're wandering.
It's a little taste of your own medicine, England.
This is for the tea party. Still angry about that. But they're walking, and they get attacked by a werewolf. And Griffin Dunne, he gets killed by a werewolf. And David Naughton, he gets maimed by a werewolf. And it seems like he's done for, but at the last minute, the villagers come and, you know, shoot the wolf dead and basically save David's life. And we see the wolf, when we see it, it's just a man. So yep. I don't know what was happening there. But anyway, so this guy, he wakes up in the hospital, and, you know, it's a hospital. There are some nurses there talking about his penis, and they ask him about what happened, and he says, you know, they say it was an escaped lunatic or something like that, though. The word lunatic does have the word moon in it.
Oh, yeah.
But he tells them that it was some sort of creature, but nobody believes him. And, you know, he spends most of the movie basically kind of in this hospital, chilling out and, you know, sort of getting to know the nurses. But there are some strange things that are happening. Like, first of all, he's not hungry. He won't eat any of the hospital slop. That's weird, right? So appetizing. But then also he starts having these strange dreams where he's running naked through the fields and forests and chasing deer. And then he eats a deer raw while naked. It's like, put on some pants first, buddy. But they're just dreams.
I mean, we all have that dream. It's like, you know, it's as common as like waking up in school in your underpants or...
He also has the Nazi werewolf dream. You have that one?
Every night. Well, this was another like distinct memory I had from when I first saw it. Not just watching the scene, but like when my dad rented the movie for me. I remember him saying, I remember like asking, like, is it scary? And he's like, well, he's like, there's one scene that's really scary. He's like, but it has nothing to do with werewolves. And I was like, okay. When I watched the movie, and it's the like the fake out moment, like after the Nazi monster people slaughter his family, it seems like he's woken up, but then the nurse gets stabbed by one of them, and they're like that. And then, I remember going back to ask my dad, it's like, was it the scene where he comes out? And he's like, yeah.
You got it.
That was it. Yeah, so good. And Jenny, I never know how to say her name. Agutter?
Yeah, I think so.
I've never had to say it. I think I had to say it out loud when we talked about Darkman earlier this year.
Right, she was in Darkman.
Yeah, and that's when I realized I'd never said her name out loud before.
It feels good in your mouth. Agutter. It's not that great.
But I think she was also playing a nurse in Darkman.
That's right. She was one of the one of the nurses that's
same universe.
And wasn't also John Landis didn't he have a cameo in that movie as well?
Oh, did he? I don't remember.
I think that's what it said when I was doing my research, but I could be wrong.
That's the other thing that was funny about watching this movie now is like, I don't like John Landis as a person.
No.
And, I spent a lot of time this summer like reading up about like the tragedy on the Twilight Zone set. And,
me too, for some reason.
Did you? That's so weird. I wrote an article about it, about how I have reinterpreted Jurassic Park as being like Steven Spielberg, like
right
through his emotions of having produced that film.
Right.
But yeah, I don't, also the other thing is like, I remember just, even just seeing like the credit, like John Landis. And I remember thinking like, who is this guy? Cause he made all of these movies that I loved as a kid. And, and I'd never like knew what he looked like or what he sounded like. He was just this kind of name and these great movies. And then, years later you find out like, oh, he's one of the most annoying people in the world.
Well, yeah. And not just that.
And
it was
and
just
other
the
things,
annoying.
Yeah. But yeah, it is funny to like, to think back on like, I wish I could go back to that when I just like loved John Landis because he was just a name and like a handful of movies that I adored.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't have all this baggage. And I'd seen the Twilight Zone movie not long after this either, but I don't think I knew about the accident because I was so young. I don't think my parents told me about it.
No. And your dad wasn't like, hey, watch out for the decapitation scene.
No, I think... he must have known. But I just watched it because I was a Twilight Zone fan. Yeah, so it's hard... Not hard to reconcile because it's not like... everyone knows about John Landis, but this movie is just like also seems kind of contrary to like him as like a personality. Like this movie is so like natural and like kind of low key and like economical in his storyline. And he's just this like over the top personality. And he seems like kind of a sociopath. And this movie is very like has a lot of like heart to it. I don't know.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we can't...
it's like there's like a duality. There's like a man and a beast.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. I like where you're going with this. All right. So, we should get through this because we regrettably have to get to Paris.
Okay. So he eventually leaves the hospital, but also Griffin Dunn comes back from the dead and says, hey, you were bitten by a werewolf, buddy. Also, I'm cursed to walk this life in limbo forever until, like, you die, so please kill yourself. And he doesn't want to kill himself because he's going to boink this nurse. And, I mean, not explicitly because that's what I'm saying. But he...
You know, I did just quickly do want to interject. Like, I did read a thing recently. It was an excerpt from a book about werewolves that I was reading for work. And there is, like, a reading. I mean, I guess it's pretty obvious because he talks about it a lot. But, like, you could read this movie as being about, like, mental health and being this...
Right.
About this, like, psychotic break, because it's not just that, like, he's hallucinating all these things. It's that, like, his hallucinations are literally telling him to kill himself and harm himself.
Yeah.
And but it's also, like, very, you know, if this is about a guy who's, like, tortured with, you know, like, thoughts of self-harm, like, it's also very, like,
seems to be having a good time doing it.
No, but it's also, like, very, like, sympathetic and feeling right. towards him. And the thing I was reading was saying, because this movie was made in 81, it's the 40th mm-hmm. anniversary, and they're saying, like, those kind of themes were starting to bubble up in movies more because, like, it wasn't until, like, the late 70s that really mental health was sort of
yeah.
becoming destigmatized, like, in a larger cultural sense. So, yeah, I think that's definitely in this movie to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so he goes and stays with this nurse. They have sex to Van Morrison's Moon Dance. Of course, now Van Morrison says that people who get vaccinated can't do the Moon Dance.
Good luck trying to have sex in one of those, like, anti-vaxxer anthems.
Yeah. Does not... It's not not sexy songs, Eric and Van. But everything seems to be good, except that he wakes up one night in naked at the zoo. Which happens to the best of us. But he first of all, he gets the attention of a small boy and gets this kid to give him his balloons to cover his nakedness. I don't think you're making anything better, man.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, balloons are not where I would I would go either. But you did skip over the part where he becomes a werewolf, which I feel like is a key part of this werewolf movie.
You're right. He does become a werewolf. And it's like he's not sure whether he's going to become a werewolf, and he's sort of like playing with the idea. He's waiting until the full moon to sort of see if this thing is going to happen. But it's not going to happen because that's crazy, right? And he's like making faces at the mirror, making werewolf noises, and it's pretty funny. But, and then he sits down to read. And the full moon thing happens, and he's in excruciating pain and just starts writhing on the floor. And then his fucking bones elongate. I hate when that happens.
And this is one of the most famous werewolf transformations.
Yeah.
Even just, like, you know, body horror, like, scenes in a movie. Like, one of the most mm-hmm. famous, like... makeup effect scenes in all of movies. This movie won the first Oscar for makeup for Rick Baker.
Yeah.
It's great. And I mean, that's another thing. Like, I remember when I first got this movie on tape, just like I would fast forward to the scene and just watch it and just like try to see how they did it. Because it really is amazing.
It's all practical effects. I mean, there's no CG. I mean, I can't believe I have to say that, but maybe like some people don't remember the era where, you know, there was no computers to do things. You had to like find ways using like, you know, chicken skins and calf bladders and stuff like that.
Yeah, and they went the CG route in the sequel, and oh my.
Yeah.
We'll get to that. But yeah. and the, you know, the other thing that's impressive, I was listening to podcast recently with Landis and Joe Dante talking about both of their movies, because The Howling came out in 81 also.
Right. That's right.
And they're talking about it, and they're talking about how it was also like, it was impressive that this scene, it's not just that it was like technically so great, it was also like really bold in terms of like werewolf movies, because like so often like the werewolf transformation is in like the dark in the woods or in the fog, mm-hmm. and this was like, it's a brightly lit living room, like there's no kind of getting away with some of it. Like, they actually had to sort of show everything.
Yeah.
And that's also partly what I think makes it so effective. That's what, I mean, that's also the, like, the, what makes this movie so effective in a nutshell, is it's like this blending of like the extraordinary, the supernatural, the mythical with like the mundane, this, the like, banalities of like day-to-day life and 80s London, like that.
Yeah.
That's what's so great about this movie. And like, it's all there in this transformation scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a great scene. Yeah. And it still has impact after 40 years. Unlike anything in Paris, but, but so yes, he wakes up naked at the zoo and then he goes home. He's feeling exceptionally good. And, until he sees on the news or reads the paper or hears that all these people were killed, and he's like, holy shit, I think that was me. And so he tries to get himself arrested, and the method that he chooses for this is maybe a little bit off. I mean, he does go up to a bobby and starts to, like, you know, and asks him to arrest him, and the bobby doesn't want to arrest him. He hasn't done anything. He calls the prince a homophobic slur.
That's, yeah. That's
what's
true.
And then, I mean, I guess at the end of this movie, there's an apology to, it says, you know, happy wishes to Diana and Charles on their upcoming nuptials.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Where's the apology to gay people, John Landis?
Yeah. I mean, to the movie's credit, I would say, like, he is trying to say something awful to,
yes,
prompt his arrest, because he thinks he's murdered people, as opposed to, like, you know, like just dropping it in casually, like like a Bill and Ted or something, you know. But yeah, no, I see your point.
Yeah, well, you know, anyway, but it doesn't work. And you know, so he sort of ends up, he's alone, and he ends up at a porno theater, as you know, as you do. And
Rob, you can understand that, certainly.
It's you know, brings me back to my times at the Metro.
I remember, for those who don't know, the Metro was a porno theater here in Toronto that is now a rock climbing gym.
Yeah, yeah.
But I remember for a while, it was also like this is in the recent past, like in the past 10 years, it was still operating as a porno theater.
Yeah.
But then it was like to help keep costs going, or to help like keep the theater afloat, like they were also renting it out for sort of more like, you know, indie cinema.
Yeah.
and stuff. So like, you know, more like hipster kind of screenings were happening. And I remember a friend of mine had like a short film playing there as part of like a, you know, some kind of program they're having, and invited me, and I was like, the porno theater? Like, I don't know if I want to go sit in the porno theater to watch a movie. He's like, it's fine.
And like, bring a garbage bag to put on your seat.
Well, that's what his girlfriend was like, wear long pants, though. I was like, I did. And I kind of wish I did, just to see it, because it was a...
It's a nice-looking theater.
An interesting theater. But this theater in American Werewolf is playing See You Next Wednesday, which is like the running John Landis gag.
Right.
In all of his movies, is a reference to See You Next Wednesday.
Interesting.
Which was also another fun thing about like following his movies as a kid, because like before the internet, like that was just a thing that we all noticed just organically from watching the movies, which was
from
fun.
Seeing porn in a movie and being like, whoa, are those boobs?
What's the title? Is it referenced elsewhere? Is it from a Kubrick movie? But also the actual porno stuff is also like very funny.
Oh yeah, it's like all these scenes where like they're having, you know, porn sex, and then they get randomly interrupted awkwardly.
Yeah, and it's like, I've never seen you before in my life. Okay. And then yeah, it's
pretty
very
clever.
Funny. And the whole scene, like this whole scene where all of David's victims are like telling him to kill himself, like
it's
of them
hilarious.
Very cheerily, like, yeah, it's almost like a Monty Python sketch or something. Like, it's so funny.
Yeah.
David, This is Harry Berman and his fiancée, Judith Browns.
Hello.
Hello.
And these gentlemen are Alf, Ted, and Joseph.
Can't say we're pleased to meet you, Mr. Kessler.
What shall I do? Suicide.
You must take your own life.
That's easy for you to say. You're already dead.
No, David. Harry and I and everyone you murder are not dead. The undead.
Why are you doing this to me?
But he doesn't kill himself. He, in fact, turns into a werewolf right there in the porno theater, eats a bunch of people who are just trying to enjoy some porno, and then he goes on like on a rampage through the streets of London, and he's eating people, he's tearing people apart. But also, there is just the mayhem that is caused by this werewolf running about. There is there is the biggest bunch of car crashes I've seen in a movie that is not explicitly about car crashes. I mean, I guess it's the most car crashes except for Blues Brothers.
Yeah, he really should have put that music over, like the ba 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 ba. Guy's getting his head crushed by a.
What does John Landis have against cars? It's gruesome though. There are so many like bodies flying out of the windshields, and it's and they're flying out of the opposite side because they're driving on the wrong side of the road. It's crazy.
Right.
But they eventually all the cops, they sort of corner David, and you know, he bites off one of the inspector's heads, and then his nurse girlfriend, also he says "I love you" like way too soon in the relationship, and she's like a little bit taken aback, and then he's like, "Oh, I've done some terrible things," which I'm going to remember that excuse for the next time I'm in a relationship and I accidentally say something too soon. Just like, "Oh, I've killed a bunch of people. It's a good out."
No, please don't get relationship advice from Rob if you're listening.
But so she sort of goes through the police lines, and she tries to like talk to Werewolf David and, you know, see if her love can't transform him. And, it can't. So,
no,
the police barely stop him from tearing her to shreds by shooting him to death. And then the movie just ends. That's it. He's dead.
It all ends with another rendition of Blue Moon, because all the songs have Moon in the title, obviously. And they play, it opens with a version of Blue Moon.
Hey.
And I think there's another one in there. But that just like, the, you know, we see, they shoot, you see David's body now in human form again. And then it cuts to black and you hear the bop, 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 bop. Like, it's
right.
Just one of the best endings.
It's pretty good.
And it, you know, what stands out to me about this movie is this is just so, like, lean. Like, there's no fat on this movie. Like, it's just, you know, it's a very simple story in a lot of ways. And it just moves through it so cleanly and concisely. And it's also, like, yeah, it's so well-paced. Like, you don't even... like, the time passes differently. Like, I remember, or I was kind of checking the time a few times watching it yesterday, and, like, you feel like the plot is just starting, but it's 35 minutes in. In,
right.
Like, a good way. Like, you feel like you're just getting going, but
he doesn't even turn into a werewolf until an hour into the movie. Into an hour of an hour of a 90-minute movie.
Yeah, but it's also, like, yeah, and it's... you know, like a so clearly delineated, like, three acts structure, you know, like 35 minutes. It's like the 35 minute mark where Griffin Dunne shows up and tells me it's a werewolf. Then there's, you know, yeah, the whole second act until he, yeah, transforms. And it's just, yeah, I especially admire just like the concision of the storytelling of this werewolf narrative.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate it so much more after having watched Paris,
mm-hmm.
Which maybe we should move into now, because...
let's go to Paris.
Holy shit. I barely remembered this movie. I'd watched some clips of it not that long ago because I was doing a thing about like bad CGI in movies, and I remembered that this was pretty rough, but the whole thing is is atrocity too strong of a word?
Probably, but let's go with it until we can think of something that's more appropriate.
Yeah, just like, holy shit. Like, it's not just like a bad follow-up to this movie. It's just a really bad movie on its own. Like
it's crazy.
Love Julie Delpy. I feel bad for her. I even feel bad for Tom Everett Scott. Who's like,
well, that's not necessary.
Not one of my favorite actors. I do remember like thinking, oh, this will be cool. He's in it because he was in That Thing You Do,
right?
Which
yes.
I did like quite a bit.
It's a classic.
Yeah, but yeah, let's talk about this.
Okay, so
thing.
Much like American Werewolf in London, this follows some American tourists, but there are three this time, and they are douchebags. I mean, they're self-described douchebags. They call themselves douchebags. They're doing their, you know, I mean, they're basically ruining Europe by...
Well, okay, so even, like, right off the bat, they're, like, three, like, bros.
Yeah.
Backpacking through Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But their, like, whole thing is, like, they're doing, like, extreme sports?
Yeah, they have these daredevil points or something that they're keeping score of. And they're also trying to sleep with women as well. But
is that where
daredevil.
You... If that's what you're doing, is that... That's where you go? You, like,
Paris?
Go backpacking through, like, Paris and all of these, like...
It's the most dangerous daredevil-y place in the world.
Okay.
I don't know.
And also, like, when we first meet them on the train, they're like, yeah, bro, like, yeah, we can fucking do this, and yeah. And they're, like, drinking glasses of red wine. It's like, I don't understand these characters.
They're in France. Come on. What are they going to drink? It's you know, it's a wet in Rome sort of thing. But so these guys...
Love Monster Energy drink.
So they're in Paris. They get there. They sneak up to the Eiffel Tower in the after it closes. And they've got this big old backpack with something in it that they allude to. And it's like, you're not actually going to use that up there. Why are you bringing it? And he's like, oh, you'll see. And it turns out that they're going to do a little bungee jumping thing off the Eiffel Tower. Now, the Eiffel Tower does not seem like a great place to bungee jump because it has that flared base, you know? I feel like that would really stop you.
I looked it up, and there a guy did bungee jump off the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah, it was Julie Delphi?
No. It was in, like, 1987 or something, and a guy did bungee jump. He lived. He was fine, but he was arrested.
That's fair.
But there is precedent. I looked it up.
Okay. All right. So while he's up there, you know, getting ready to do this thing, he sees this pretty French woman who is standing at the edge, and she is going to commit suicide because these French women are so moody. But... he tells her to stop, and, you know, she's not going to listen to him, and she jumps, and then he goes after her, and he makes himself aerodynamic so that he can catch up with her, and he grabs her, but the bungee isn't attached, and so his two numbskull friends sort of are holding it, and they all don't die. Julie Delphi gets, you know, gently let down onto the ground. But when he goes back up, he does hit the tower in the head, and he wakes up in the hospital. Perhaps a nod to the first film where the
Definitely
wakes up
yeah.
in the hospital. Yeah.
Hold on. Are you saying Julie Delphi, like the Oracle of Delphi?
Oh, I am, but maybe that's wrong.
It's Delphi.
But I feel like she could tell me the future.
Yeah.
Okay, Delphi.
Delphi, Julie Delphi. Yeah, so he's in the hospital, but, like, okay, we're already kind of deviating from the original while still, like, following it. So he's, like, in the hospital, but, like, nothing interesting is really happening because he's not turning into a werewolf.
Well, he has to return Julie Delpy's shoe.
Yeah, I mean... That's a thing that happens. So he gets out.
He falls in love
with
her.
He sees her.
Julie Delphi.
She steals like a heart from a surgery, and he sees her, and then he wants to try and find her. Okay, we're like 8 minutes into this movie, and there's
Julie Delphi's already stealing hearts.
Yeah, well, there's a joke about that, like, because the surgeon's like, she stole my heart, and he's like, you and me both, buddy. Right. It's like, why would you make a joke like? A surgeon, a doctor just told you something legitimately horrifying about this person.
Later on, they should have made a Julie Delpy eat your heart out joke.
Right. Yeah. But okay, yeah. So I was going to say, you know, one difference between this movie and the original is in this movie, only 8 minutes into the movie, we get a humorous montage set to All Star by Smash Mouth.
No. Isn't it Walking on the Sun?
Oh, fuck. You're right. It is the Sun.
Yeah. You know. And, you know, I hope the guy from Smash Mouth is doing okay. Because I heard he had some troubles lately.
That's the other, you know, the first movie was like the music selections were so purposeful. Like they're
all
Moon.
All this great old music.
But yeah, and they weren't all like songs from 1981. Like, you know, and I'm not saying they should have done, you know, had all Moon songs again in the second one. But it's just like I think the opening credits are like a Bush song. It's just so painfully 1997.
Yeah, I believe the Bush song Mouth was, I think they maybe did a promotional music video with scenes from this movie. Because Julie Delpy's in it. But yeah, I mean, it's just very 90s. It's very, you know, it's soaked in the 90s-isms. But yeah, so they want to go, he wants to go return the shoe to Julie Delpy, and so he tracks her down and goes to her house. But she is not happy to see him. I mean, for good reason. But also because she was in the middle of something, and her hands are bloody when she answers the door. So that's weird. They think that she's trying to kill herself again, but she says she's just painting.
Hi, I'm Andy. We met on the tower. This is Chris and Brad. And listen, this I thought that you would want this, and well, it's not my size.
You're very kind. Now go, please. You must not stay here.
Charming.
And sophisticated. Forget about it. Let's go, Andy.
Wait, did you see what I saw?
What?
She had blood on her hand. She's trying it again.
She agrees to meet Tom Everett Scott for a date at, you know, in front of the music hall where we find out her parents were murdered. But, so he goes to do that, and they have a nice time. But I think they go to see to find her or something, and they meet up with this other dude named Claude. Yeah.
First of all, their date, they don't have a good time. There's like
it's a bad
whole
date.
Extended scene where like he drops a condom and pretends it's chewing gum. So she's like, "Okay, chew it and blow a bubble," and he blows up the condom.
Yes,
with his, and then. And that's the whole scene. And then she's like, "You're a creep," and runs off. And she's like bicycling away, and he runs after her, and like chases her down, stops her, and then she says something. And he's like, "Oh, you don't want to go on a date with me?" It's like, no, she fucking doesn't. She's trying. She's literally in the act of fleeing.
You just chewed on a condom, buddy. You've ruined your chances. Give it up.
I mean, like, yeah, Before Sunrise would have been like a 20-minute movie if Ethan Hawke started munching on a condom in the first act. But yeah, no, he's just this kind of creepy dope, and his friends are awful. But he keeps trying to stalk this girl and harass her, and they go back to her house, and yeah, some other guy's there and is basically like, "Hey, come to this underground rave." And it's like a werewolf rave, we'll find out. The werewolf raves factor in this movie. Yeah, they're like...
There's like seven werewolf raves in this movie.
They're totally like, "Well, we like American Werewolf in London. What if we had more Smash Mouth songs and raves and bungee jumping?"
Ka-ching! Yeah. Yeah, well, this is a werewolf raid. And they're like, they're gathering up homeless people and Americans, and they sort of...
It's true, they are gathering up Americans. And it's also like, that's also what was so good about the first movie in terms of like, you know, feeling like an outsider. You know, I forgot to mention there is like a interesting visual, I guess you call it like a visual essay or a video on the DVD or the Blu-ray of American Werewolf in London about how like the movie is more like an allegory for like David's Judaism.
Right.
Like it's like, that's why it's like,
that's,
you know,
why
it's
they
not...
talk about the circumcision.
Yeah. Like it's like, that's why he's like, you know, made to feel like an outsider by this like sort of Anglo-Saxon community. But that's also, you know, like the fear of like the Nazi. They're, like, they're not just like demons or werewolves that murder his family. Like they're literal Nazis. But so anyway, so like partly what makes that whole sense of isolation work so well is like it's just him. Like Jack is his only friend there is killed. He's on his own in this strange city.
This movie has too many douchebags.
This movie's got so many guys, so many dudes hanging around, and it just like it has none of that. Like it's just like basic things that made the original. Like I get the original, you know, is considered a classic. This was never going to be that, but there are just like certain things. They copy so much from the formula, but then they just screw up so many things.
Yeah. But so at this werewolf thing, one guy goes back to get Julie Delpy because she's not around and finds her in a cage. And she tells him to go away. He tells her that Tom Everett Scott's at this party, and then she gets really concerned and asks to be let out of this cage. And she goes sort of rushing out there to save him because it is a werewolf party. And all these people, they
not a werewolf bar mitzvah. Just to
that's
clear.
A different thing.
That's a different thing.
That would be more appropriate for the first movie, though. Right. But yeah, and like they're killing all these people, and his friends sort of barely escape. I guess one doesn't escape. One gets eaten. Or gets killed and sort of ends up washing into the gutter. And Tom Everett Scott, he barely escapes, and he ends up like spearing a werewolf with a piece of like a gate or something like that. And just as he's escaping out of the tube, not the subway, this sewer tube, he gets mauled by the werewolf in the leg. And you know what that means? You know he's got to buy new pants because his leg's torn. But. You know, I mean, he's going to turn into a werewolf. So he wakes up at Julie Delpy's place, and Julie Delpy is, you know, making a shake of sorts with a couple of human hearts, and she brings it in to give to this guy to drink. And he's not quite ready to hear, you know, the new truth about him. So she does this really clever thing where she takes off her shirt and then puts his hands on her breast and then is like, "You're a werewolf." It softens the blow, you know?
Yeah, good point. And it softens the blow and also gives them a scene to put in every commercial for that movie. Like, I remember that being a big selling point for 1997's horny teenager, you know, audience.
Wait, something weird is going on here. I gotta go.
Shh. My friends.
You must. Please. This will relax, you know?
I don't get it. Last time we met, you threw bricks at me.
Listen. You're not the same as you used to be.
Only since I met you.
Seriously. There's something I have to tell you.
This movie is like literally like, what if we took American Werewolf in London and mixed it with American Pie?
American Werewolf Pie in London? No. It's a whole weird scene because he also like he starts having the hallucination dream within a dream things. Mm-hmm. They try to do it. But it's also too late. Like now, I don't know. Like. I don't know. And he sees, like, her mother, who's, like, a walking corpse.
Right.
Like, what, Griffin Dunn.
Did you hear, like, that's supposed to be the tie-in to the first movie?
I had read that possibly that was... because it doesn't really make sense when you find out kind of all the details about her backstory.
No.
But, like, the fact that her mom was also a nurse makes it seem like... And she had, like, her father died and she had a stepfather or whatever. Like, it made it seem like quite possibly what the original story was going to be was they were going to tie it to the first movie by having it be, like, Julie Delpy's character was a werewolf because she was conceived by werewolf. Because, yeah, her father was
it's
David
Notton.
It's passed
on that way, fluidly.
Yeah. So, like, I mean, at least that would have been something.
Yeah. It does feel very like it doesn't really have any sort of connection. I mean, to the original movie, and it does feel like a little bit like what, why? But
and
at
then
the same
like,
time.
And then they have kind of like a fight, and then he goes and he meets Julie Bowen for some reason.
Yeah, that's right. Who we should say was Jack Shepard's ex-wife that he tried to save on Lost, but then he didn't love her, and then they had to get divorced.
She's also on Modern Family.
Well, I don't watch that. I just rewatch Lost every 3 years. Yeah. But he goes. You know, they have like a very sexy time. They go to desecrate Jim Morrison's grave by having sexy times on it, or maybe that's what he would want. He's probably like looking up from above and being like, "All right, let me join in." Ooh, that's what he sounds like. But he turns into a werewolf and eats her. So, you know, she's dead, but she comes back, so it's okay. Yeah, and also his friend comes back, and that's, you know, he tells him, hey, you're a werewolf. But he doesn't want him to kill himself. He wants him to kill Serafina, because he thinks that Julie Delpy's character, Serafina, is the one
I think it's Seraphine or something.
Oh, you're right, yeah. Who has killed him and bitten him. So that's what she's the sort of thing. And he feels sort of conflicted because he doesn't want to kill this lady because he kind of likes her because she's gorgeous and French and she's just so, I don't know, wonderful. And she has like a charming voice and her accent is really wonderful. But
you
yeah,
okay?
I'm fine. Just going through something. But she's dead. Julie Bowen.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much we want to talk about this, but the big werewolf rave at the end. Oh, and there's a werewolf fight. I mean, this is the other stupid thing. It's like the original is such a simple story. This adds so many characters, and this must have been a studio note at some point where they're like, can we have good werewolves and bad werewolves?
So it sets up the big, you know, American Werewolf IP, you know? Yeah. it's also sort of like, you know, it's like the vampire theater thing in Interview with the Vampire. They basically do the same thing, invite a bunch of people to the thing and then massacre them. But, these werewolves...
Like the CGI in these werewolves, it's not just simply like, oh, you know, like it was 1997, like CGI wasn't quite there yet. Like
it was bad for the time.
Yeah, it was bad.
They don't even look
time.
Like wolves. They look like I don't know, some sort of like marmots or something.
They look like, you remember the show Animorphs when the people would morph in animals? It looks like if you like pause mid morph and look at you know, the that it looks like a paused Animorph, but like in motion.
Yeah. So the werewolf cult, they want to like cleanse the earth of all the scum, which I guess includes Americans, and you know, and live in a world like that. And he gives this whole big speech about how he wants to live in like a world without technology while there's like a boombox on the altar next to them. It's like, where are you going to listen to your Gregorian chants when you you know, killed all the humans and taken all the technology away? But they have this like serum because Julie Delpy's stepdad was working on this potion that would make her...
Should we just stop? I mean, this movie is just...
Yeah, it's pretty much...
There's a magic potion at the end.
There's
like,
a magic potion. Is there... Okay, well, what of note... Is there anything of note that we should talk about with American Werewolf in Paris before we, you know, leave it to the viewers, listeners?
Nope. I don't think... Well, I mean, also the ending is just, like, we talked about...
Right. The first one has that, like, ending where, like, the protagonist dies. His girlfriend is, like, shocked and horrified and could do nothing to save him. And, in fact, you know, was there when he got killed. And this one ends on a completely different note with Julie Delpy and the guy bungee jumping off the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah. What was that? Again, like they're like, well, you know, the kids really came for bungee jumping. We should probably get another bungee jumping scene into the end of the movie.
They should have used the bungee jumping to somehow stop the main werewolf. like, oh, he doesn't know that I got this bungee, and then like jump off something and is like, oh, it's bungee.
I could see, like, this movie was like three drafts away from just being about bungee jumping and like having no werewolves in it.
An American bungeeist in Paris.
One of the bungees again wasn't like tied up, like,
yeah, these guys are just like terrible and negligent at safety. Like, how many people have they, you know, they probably started off with like five bros, two of them died in like, it was like Rome.
It was like 16 Americans went to Europe and two came back,
and they were all killed by the werewolf, huh? No, just one by the werewolf, the rest were bungee, man.
Statistically, werewolves are safer than bungee jumping.
Yeah.
It's been proven the lycanthropy is far safer to the average American than unsupervised bungee accidents. This movie, God.
Oh, I guess, Lord. The one thing is that he discovers that it wasn't Julie Delpy who bit him. It was Claude. And so he doesn't have to eat out Julie Delpy's heart. Which, that's good. And instead, he pretty hilariously eats out this guy's heart. And it looks like, you know, not even a cutscene from a video game. It looks like actual gameplay from a PlayStation 1.
Yeah.
It's funny.
Yeah.
But that's an American werewolf in Paris and an American werewolf in London. And so I have some trivia and some behind the scenes, mostly about American Werewolf in London. Right after this break.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Welcome back to Rewatchability. We are talking about American Werewolf in London and, to a lesser extent, American Werewolf in Paris. I've got some trivia for you, JM, so okay. you better be ready. This is some hard stuff because there's not a lot about. This one I think you could get because I'm sort of shooting it right in your direction. So
okay,
which song did Bob Dylan not agree to allow to be put in this movie? Bob Dylan, the folk singer.
Wait,
you're a big
which
Bob
movie?
Dylan fan. This American Werewolf in London, I should say.
It's got to be one with Moon in the title, I guess. Right?
Well, yeah, I guess so.
What's a Bob Dylan song with Moon in the title? Moon. Like a rolling moon.
Desolation Moonrow.
Tombstone Moons.
Blowing in the moon wind.
I can't. No one wants to listen to me think about this. What is it?
Okay. Well, it's a bit of a trick question because it's not one that he wrote, but it was his cover of Blue Moon, which is in this movie by other artists. But the Bob Dylan version does not appear.
Wait, when did he cover Blue Moon?
In the late 60s. I listened to it. It sounds pretty good.
Oh, is it the one on that like album just called Dylan that was like thrown together?
Maybe.
Like by
Yeah,
Columbia,
I think it was just a demo.
Yeah,
probably. But the reason that Bob Dylan wouldn't allow this movie to be used in his song to be used in the American Werewolf in London was because it was when Bob Dylan was going through his Christian phase, his slow train of coming, and he didn't feel that the movie had good values.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry, it's on Self-Portrait.
There you go.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, and apparently they also couldn't use the Elvis Presley version of Blue Moon because of legal things.
Right.
Legal. Werewolves we can't are have like to... lawyers.
How many? There's like three versions of it in here, right? Like, I think that's enough.
Well, I think probably they would have like not had one of those ones, maybe.
You know? Oh, okay. I see.
But, yeah. Okay. So, you know what? That was a tough one.
That was a tough one. Because, I don't know. I have it and I've listened to it, but I don't listen to Self-Portrait that often. Okay. I like it though. I think it's underrated.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't actually know if I've heard that one. Maybe I'll put it on my Spotify. Okay, so
yeah,
which movie reunites John Landis, Griffin Dunne, and Jenny Agutter?
Oh, John Landis movie. Give me a clue.
I feel like he wasn't the only director on this movie.
Oh, was it Amazon Women on the Moon?
That's correct.
Okay.
And Griffin Dunne was in his segment, but Jenny Agutter wasn't. But she shows up.
Who's she in it? I don't remember her.
Oh, you know what? I think actually her segment got cut, it's cut from some versions of it. So it's out there, but it's not maybe in the final movie.
The Griffin Dunne bit's hilarious. It's the one where he's the doctor that loses Peter Horton, I think, and Michelle Pfeiffer's baby. That's a funny bit. Okay, all right, keep going.
Okay, this one's really hard.
Oh, fuck.
But I think if you get it, I think it'll be rewarding. Okay, so which cast member of American Werewolf in London has a role in Star Wars Return of the Jedi?
Jesus. An American Werewolf in London.
Yeah, it's not Griffin Dunne.
Well, see, all those English character actors were...
It's true. It could be anybody. It
could be anybody. I feel like I...
Wait, did I say which Star Wars movie it was?
Did you say Return of the Jedi?
Yeah, I did. Okay. All right.
Was it Empire and Jedi or just Jedi?
Just Jedi, I think.
Oh, shit.
And, okay, he's in Jabba's palace.
Okay, that's not what I was thinking.
He's a tall man.
No, I don't know.
There's no way that you could have... I mean, maybe... I don't know how much Star Wars nerds know about Star Wars, but I would have only known this by clicking on the IMDb's and looking, doing a deep dive through these people's filmographies. So it's not like I have some special knowledge that I'm, you know, lording over you or anything, but I did happen to see this, and I thought it was interesting.
Okay.
The guy who plays... I think his name is Gerard something. He... The one who gets killed in the subway... In the tube.
Right.
He is the actor who plays Bib Fortuna.
Right. I did know that. I think I heard someone else on a podcast say that.
That's the sort of stuff you hear on podcasts.
And he was in something else too, that guy.
Yeah. He was for sure. I mean, most of these actors have been in other things.
Well, yeah.
Griffin Dunne was in My Girl.
I thought you were maybe going to ask about a trivia question about Rick Mail, who's in the pub scene.
I did see him there, yeah. Which Drop Dead Fred actor is in.
and Frank Oz, we didn't mention, too, also
That's right.
Shows up.
Well, twice. He's also on the TV screen as Miss Piggy. Oh, yeah, it's like that doctor sounds a lot like Fozzie Bear.
It's also funny, like, because he really sounds like Bert in the scene where, I guess he always sounds like that, but like the part where he's going, Mr. Kessler, Mr. Kessler.
Right.
Like, it's just so.
See, I heard Fozzie.
Oh, okay, interesting.
Yeah. There were some other interesting notes that I found while I was plumbing the IMDb, like, and Wikipedia. For example, in the main actress in the porno movie, whose name is Lindsay Drew, she was an actual pornographic actress who was arrested for, like, distributing pornography. But she was also sort of famously on the front cover of that Roger Waters album. What's it called? Hitchhiking Naked or something?
Okay, I don't know.
Do you know that one? Have you
no.
seen that one?
Okay. No, I don't.
Well, if you've ever looked through like an HMV cutout bin, anyway, I thought that was interesting. But also she was in a lot of movies, a lot of Ken Russell movies as well, which is sort of interesting. And also Nina Carter, who was in that scene that David watches on the TV where it's like, ooh, who is this bad actress? And, you know, what's her naughty secrets?
Yeah, yeah.
She was in a band called Blonde on Blonde, name of a Dylan album, which was, I kid you not, big in Japan. It was big in Japan. They were big in Japan.
Okay.
Which I've heard it as a cliche. I seldom read about people who were actually big in Japan. And their big song was a cover of Led Zeppelin's Whole Lot of Love, which I could not find on the internet.
Oh, wow.
And she was married to Rick Wakeman, too. But, you know, that's less impressive of the being big in Japan. Okay, so behind the scenes stuff.
Oh, wait, I just want to say the guy who plays Bib Fortuna and the subway guy here, his name is Michael Carter.
Mm-hmm.
His character's name is Gerald.
Yes.
And he is in a bunch of other stuff, but nothing quite as big as either of those. He's in The Keep, the Michael Mann movie, but
right,
yeah, I think maybe like on an episode of Star Wars Minute or something, someone mentioned the Bib Fortuna American Werewolf Connection.
Oh, yeah, a lot of the cast apparently were actually appearing on the West End at on a production of Nicholas Nickleby.
And oh, really?
Just sort of like pulled them in, yeah, like the Doctor, I think, was in that Nicholas Nickleby.
Oh, he's so good. I love that Doctor.
Yeah. Also, the cop with the mustache, he's really funny, too. Who's always, like, dropping the puke things or whatever.
That's that whole, like, even that, you know, we talk about the comedy in the movie and the naturalism of the movie. Like, even just, like, yeah, the scene with the two cops, like, having one of them be younger and more presumptuous and one of them be older and, like, more, you know, kind of trying to keep him in his place. Like, yeah, imbuing those sort of expositional scenes with these little character eccentricities. It's just so great.
Yeah. Apparently, John Landis got the idea for this movie while he was in Yugoslavia, where he was working on Kelly's Heroes. He was at a funeral in Europe, and, you know, these superstitious people, they buried the person in a very deep hole, feet first, and covered in garlic. And he was like, oh, that's weird. They must be afraid of something happening. And he thought werewolves, even though garlic, clearly vampire town. But that's where he sort of got the idea. He had it sort of kicking around for a long time. Like, he says that he got the idea in 1969. He brought it to people. They said it was too scary to be a comedy and too funny to be a horror movie. So it took him a long time to get it made. And, eventually he did. They had, you know, it was a very small crew that they took over to England. They had problems getting Griffin Dunne a visa, apparently, or a work permit, and he didn't know what he was going to do because, you know, you need Griffin Dunne to make this movie. And so apparently John Landis wrote a letter and threatened to rewrite the script as An American Werewolf in Paris. And,
right.
And then they, you know, let him in, and then he didn't have to do that. He's like, I'll write a bungee scene, I will.
Yeah, it's an even bigger threat than they thought, yeah.
That's right. But,
wow.
Yeah. So, you know, that's what they did.
I have one piece of trivia about this movie I wanted to mention.
Okay.
And that is, do you know about the sequel that John Landis pitched for this?
Well, yeah, before they made American Werewolf in Paris, they did ask John Landis to write a script and pitch a version of this. And it was something like the nurse is still there and she's investigating the murders that happened 20 years ago or something like that.
It's even weirder. It focuses on, because I wrote about it one time. I read like an interview with him in like, it was like an old issue of Starlog or Fangoria or one of those magazines. And he talks all about it, but it was like the main character of this movie is Debbie Klein. And if you'll remember, Debbie Klein is the friend of theirs that they briefly objectify at the beginning of the movie. Like,
yeah.
Griffin Dunn's talking about how he
that doesn't have a mediocre body.
Right, exactly. And
so this hot-bodied woman, Debbie Klein.
The idea is, like, I think they were going to, like, sort of retcon it. So, like, David wrote Debbie Klein a letter while he was going through all the werewolf stuff.
Oh.
And then she, like...
20 years later.
Because she was, like, secretly having an affair with him without David's knowledge. And so she starts, she's suspicious about his death and comes to England and starts investigating. And then weirdly, the like Nazi mutant werewolf demon creatures from David's dream.
They're back.
Even though that was just his dream.
That wasn't a dream.
And apparently Debbie randomly, I'm quoting myself, I'm reading an old article, is Debbie randomly starts having them, starts seeing them too, when she's, Debbie randomly starts having the same dream and then starts seeing those guys when she's awake. And then according to John Landis, quote, the violence becomes so overwhelming that the audience would eventually lose sight of what was real and what wasn't.
Wow.
And then... Debbie would eventually find Alex, the nurse, the love interest, and in a shocking
twist, they have a cat fight.
Well, she sees her like making out with someone, but then we see that it's David's corpse she's making out with, and like she's a werewolf too now. But she, so she's like having visions of his like undead spirit, and they're like just continuing their relationship. And
that's weird.
And then a bunch of stuff happens, and I guess Alex dies. They all die, and then it ends with it ends with Jack and David together again, walking into the afterlife. And Jack turns to David and says, "So you fucked Debbie Klein, huh?" And that's the end of the movie.
Wow. Okay. I can't believe that. I can't believe I thought that American Werewolf in Paris was the lowest that it was going to get on this podcast. But that's bad. First of all, putting this thing in their friendship, Griffin would never sleep with David. They would never do that.
No, it's David. Yeah. Anyways, I that may have just been like,
That's pretty.
I don't know if he actually wanted to do that, but they made this movie instead, and. Yeah, it's not good.
Did you read that John Landis had to sort of lure Rick Baker away from The Howling for this? Because apparently he had talked to Rick Baker. They were going to make this movie. They'd worked on some of the preliminary designs and all that stuff, but he couldn't get the funding. And then when he finally did get the funding, Rick Baker was already set to work on The Howling. And so he had to sort of he put his next in charge of that and only consulted on The Howling and came to work on American Werewolf in Paris. But apparently John Landis was still pissed because the werewolves in The Howling looked too much like the werewolves in American Werewolf in London.
Yeah, well, I think the person that Rick Baker left in charge of The Howling, if I'm not mistaken, was Rob Bottin.
Yeah.
Who went on to become, effects legend, did all the creature effects for The Thing.
Right.
A legend in his own right. So, yeah, no slouch there. But, come on, John. It's a werewolf. Like, there's only so many variations.
It's got
variations.
Ears, it's a tail, it's a fuzzy thing, There's only so many directions you can go.
Yeah.
That's pretty much all that I have for behind-the-scenes stuff with American Werewolf in London. Oh, at one point the studio wanted Dan Aykroyd and James Belushi to star.
John Belushi.
Yeah, John Belushi to star in it. That would have been shitty. But
yeah, I mean, that's, you know what, that it would have been too broad. It would have been something else. Like, what makes this movie work so well is, like, these guys feel believable, like, right from the jump. Like, it, and, you know, it's interesting, like, I was thinking about it, about watching it for the first time now more than I ever have before, because we're doing it for the podcast, and thinking about, like, you know, I watched this movie specifically because I thought it would be less scary because it was also funny, or, you know, I thought I'd be able to take it better or something, which was true at the time, certainly. But, like, watching it now, I find, like, oh, that's actually what makes it scarier in a way.
Right.
Because, like, everybody's kind of, like, acting or joking around like you or
people
your friends might
life.
Joke around. Yeah, exactly. And, like, that
it doesn't
makes
stop the scary things.
Yeah, and when the scary stuff hits, it, like, hits harder because it's in a world that feels
all
like,
that is shattered.
Yeah. Well, and it's just, like, it's a world that feels, like, so grounded and so relatable that, like, it's the idea that this could happen. And it's also, you know, I obviously wasn't thinking about this at the time when I saw it because it hadn't come out yet, but, like, thinking of, like, the sort of meta horror, maybe revolution's too strong a word, but, like, the popularization of that trend that came with Scream in what that was 96, I think. But, like, that, you know, that was kind of like, you know, after that, every horror movie was, like, you know, talking about horror movies. Or, like, you know, like, bringing up horror movies in the horror movie, which, you know, it obviously had been done before, but, like,
well, American Werewolf in London does it.
Well, that's the thing, like, watching it now, it's like, oh yeah, like, this is, like, they all relate to all the werewolf stuff. Like, both Jack and David relate to the werewolf stuff through the lens of, like, the Wolfman movie and the Universal movie. And yeah, it was just interesting to think about, like, to think about it as kind of like of having kind of paved the way for that trend a bit as well. Cause I don't think it really gets talked about in that context as much, because it's certainly not a focus, but, like, that's how, which is also, like, that's what I was saying. It makes it scary. It makes it more relatable, because, like, if that were to happen to, like, you or me, like, that's how we would
be terrifying.
Interpret the, you know, what was happening, like, through, like, movies we'd seen. So,
yeah.
Yeah, man, it's just so great. And everything that's wrong about American Werewolf in Paris, like, you can just look at its counterpart in the first movie and see how it's done better, because they do so much that's similar. Like, even, like, talking about the relatability of the two characters, like, we have a very similar scene to the scene where Jack and David are walking through, you know, the English countryside and just chatting. Like, we get the version of that with, like, the three bros on the train, but, like, that feels like, you know, a 47-year-old screenwriter just, like, banging out a draft before lunch so he can just be done with it, and, like, you know, sketching out this cartoon version of three American youths, whereas the other just feels so natural and so believable. And, you know, that's the trick of the movie, really.
Yeah. And it makes the characters are so great. They really do, like, I think they draw you in, and they're like friendship and sort of, you know, they're like sort of like friendly bickering is lots of fun, you know? Did you read any stuff on the internet about, like, the sort of, like, queer interpretations of this movie?
Not Paris or London.
London.
No, I didn't.
Well, there's at least one essay out there that I took a read at, and it's sort of like positions like, you know, I mean, like, the werewolf is the sexuality, and he tries to sort of, like, not embrace it or something like that. I don't know. It's out there. Go Google it if you're interested in the queering of American Werewolf in London.
I definitely, like, heard that, you know, applied to, like, the older, like, the Universal movies, like the original, like, the Wolfman, and also, like, you know, famously, like, Harry Potter, they, you know,
I don't know.
Noted ally J.K. Rowling claimed that that the sort of werewolf character in that franchise was supposed to be like an allegory for a queer character. But yeah, wow. I hadn't really read about it in terms of this movie, but
sort of interesting. I mean, I don't know. It does seem like maybe like a little bit of a stretch, but like the friendship between David and Jack. I mean, it does seem very familiar. Like it could almost be like a code for like a relationship or something like that. And that would also like sort of speak to the sort of outsiderness of their experience. But yeah, there was also a really good thing. If you are interested in American Werewolf in Paris, there was a good interview or something with the screenwriters, one of whom is from Toronto, actually.
Really?
Yeah, I think his name is Tom Burns. But yeah, apparently, like they had like a bunch of ideas for the movie, and it seems like it could have been like kind of okay, but then the director came in and put his stamp on it, and a lot of the things went, you know, all over the place. So it's sort of interesting to see where it went wrong.
Mm. I forgot the other thing I wanted to mention about American Werewolf in Paris is we haven't talked about that it was directed by a guy named Anthony Waller.
Yeah.
Who got the gig to make this movie because he had made a movie called Mute Witness.
Right.
Did you ever see that?
No.
I have always wanted to see that. I've heard it's really good. And it's hard to find these days. I think it's all on YouTube right now.
Okay.
So I think I might watch it because I've always wanted to see it. But it's got a really interesting story behind one of the cameos in it, because it's the last, I believe it's the last screen appearance by Alec Guinness.
Yeah, I saw him in the cast there.
Yeah, and the
Obi-Wan.
The movie came out in 1995. What? Alec Guinness filmed his scene in 1985.
What?
And it's this crazy scene, or this crazy story where like, this guy, Anthony Waller, was just like, I think he was at some kind of party. I don't remember what it was. It was somewhere in Europe or something. He was at some kind of like event, and Alec Guinness was there. And he struck up a conversation with him, and he told him about this movie. And it was like, I would love for you to
need Obi-Wan
a small part in it. And he was like, oh, you know, like I'd love to, but
I'm gonna die soon.
No. Well, he was still alive. He lived into the 90s. But he said, I'd love to, but I'm like booked solid for like the next 18 months. So this guy, Anthony Waller, like got him to read the script, got him to agree to it, wrote a scene specifically for Alec Guinness, hired a camera crew overnight, and shot the scene the next day.
Wow.
Just because it was like the only chance to like Alec Guinness filmed his scene the morning, the next day after he met this guy, and then got on a plane at like lunchtime.
That's kind of awesome. But like, I can't imagine how like the footage would match up to like something that was filmed 10 years later.
Well, I think they did have to like do like reverse something in it or something, but it was also like its own little scene. Like I don't like, it's basically a cameo, right? And I don't think he like interacts with the other characters necessarily, but it is also funny. It's like he was busy for the next 18 months and it was like, oh, I better film it now. But then he didn't end up making the rest of the movie for 10 years. So
that's
he probably could have just cast him the old fashioned way.
One other thing I thought was really funny was that apparently David Naughton, who, you know, he's had a career, but he hasn't done a lot of like really big roles. Before this movie, he was apparently known for the Dr. Pepper commercials. He was like the Dr. Right. Pepper spokesperson. And like so much, he was so well recognized as this that even like at the end of the movie, when they shot his like death scene, after that, they like all the crew like danced around him singing the Dr. Pepper tune or whatever. Or John Landis even says that he hired the guy because he saw him in the Dr. Pepper commercial, and in the Dr. Pepper commercial he says, I'm a pepper, you're a pepper, and John Landis was like, I'm a pepper, so I and he's a pepper, so we had a lot in common. I didn't see the commercial, so I don't know. I don't know. It's weird. But apparently, he lost his Dr. Pepper gig because of all the scenes of his dong in this movie. It's Dr. Pepper, not Dr. Pecker. And, yeah.
You've been waiting like 2 hours to say that, haven't you?
Longer. Okay, let's wrap it up. JM, tell me, how did you feel rewatching American Werewolf in London and then American Werewolf in Paris?
Yeah, I mean, I love the first one. I continue to love it. I think it's just such a great movie. And it's you know, one of those movies that you can rewatch over and over again. Like I said, because it's just so so concise and like so simple, and like, yeah, it's just this kind of perfectly constructed story that feels both small and huge at the same time. It's like very intimate and down to earth, but also like, you know, huge and mythical and supernatural. And it pulls off that balance perfectly. I mean, also just like the atmosphere in this movie, like watching this movie, like you feel like you are in these places. Like, I feel like I've been to the Slaughtered Lamb. I feel like I've been on the moors. It's just, yeah, it's so palpable. Like even like the spaces, like the hospital and the apartment, like they just all feel so like you could step into them. I don't know. It's just such a great movie. I love it. And the performances, and David Naughton, like you talked about, like, it's not like he became a huge star or anything after this, but he's really good in it.
It's a great performance.
Yeah. And as we saw with Tom Everett Scott, like, it's not always easy to to pull that off. Yeah, and watching that movie again, like, I kind of thought, like, oh, it's going to be, like, not great, especially because it's, you know, like, following up this classic, but I did not expect it to be quite so horrific. Like, I mean, like, yeah, even just, like, taking... It's not just that they took what worked about the first movie and didn't do it as well. It's like they took what worked about the first movie and like either didn't get it or like ruined it. Like, yeah. Even like the first time they have like the Tom Everett Scott character, like talking to one of like the undead souls that's tormented by, you know, being stuck in this limbo. The first time he does that, he's like in the bathroom. And so they kind of turn it into like a dick joke where it sounds like, yeah, he's talking to no one and someone else is in the stall. It's like, why did you, I don't know. And like, it's just, it's obscene. I hated it. I wish it didn't exist. Yeah, but it is like the most 90s movie.
It is a very 90s movie.
If you wanted it most, and I feel bad for Julie Delpy because I love Julie Delpy.
She's adorable.
And
a great actress.
And she's got a new show right now.
Cultural treasure. Does she?
Is. Yeah.
Cool. I'll watch that.
And yeah, so I hate it, and I love the first one. And for a movie that's about duality, yeah, maybe it makes sense for one to be wonderful and one to be terrible. But like I said, I have separate feelings about its filmmaker, John Landis, and I will separate the art from the artist in this instance and continue to enjoy this movie. What about you, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't seen it before, but it was pretty enjoyable. I mean, it is a lot slower than, you know, a lot of modern movies. There's less that sort of happens, but I think it has a great tone and atmosphere. And I think the performances of the two guys, I mean, they really make the first part of the movie, and it's sort of, you know, it works all the way through. It is a crazy movie. I mean, there's so much, like, John Landis stuff in it, like the 90 million car crashes. And,
yeah,
you know, I feel like some of, like, the Frank... sexualness, but I think, yeah, I think it's a good movie, and yeah, I would watch it again. As for American Werewolf in Paris, yeah, I mean, I tried to give it a chance. You know, those characters do feel like people who existed in the 90s. It felt like that. They felt like you know, they were real. But it was bad. The performances were bad. I mean, all of those three guys have very punchable faces. Julie Delpy was great. She was better than she had great, to be. Yeah. She didn't have to be that good. But she really gave it her all. And
it feels like they met Julie Delpy at a party, shot all of her stuff the next day, and then like cut it in with these like jackasses. And I like Tom Everett Scott, but he does not give a good performance here.
No, it's a really bad performance.
And like the other guys, like his friends are like, one of them is just like one of those guys is in a bunch of 90s things. One of them I recognize is like a guy who played like the super in Frasier's building in like a few episodes of Frasier.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, not good. And also like the last thing I want to say is also in terms of like the theme of like, you know, the outsider, that is so much a part, like it's right there in the title. It's an American werewolf in London. Mm. Like the first movie is so about being an outsider, and you know, we can take that theme and apply it to various, you know, other allegorical or thematic readings of it. And I think that's interesting, but I also love that it's nuanced enough that it also like tells variations of that story, even within the world of the movie. Like
right.
We also get the scene where the doctor who's starting to get suspicious about it also goes to the slaughtered lamb. Mm-hmm. And he's also
an outsider in a whole different way.
Yeah. He's an outsider because he's this like, you know, posh
city doctor.
London doctor. Yeah. So they don't have the drink he wants at the bar, and he's, you know,
and the townspeople are sort of like intimidated by him.
Yeah. So I love that too. Like it's not just about one thing. It's about like how people are all, you know, territorial in different ways. Like everybody is to a certain extent. I don't know. I love that movie. I also see new things in it every time. And I will never watch an American Werewolf in Paris ever again. If you try to make me, I will fight you.
You know what? I don't think that's going to have to happen, you know? Yeah, so that's rewatchability. Oh, I also wanted to say, well, anyway.
No, what were you going to say?
Well, John Landis's stupid fucking kid was going to remake.
Oh, that's right.
But I think that's maybe not happening.
No,
now.
It's not. It's not.
There was also a guy who was trying to shop around a threequel called An American Werewolf in Rome. Rome, Italy.
Okay.
But I don't know. I don't know how that's going. I say at this point, just like sort of merge them with like The Trip. You know, you can have like Steve Coogan. Maybe he gets attacked by American Werewolf. They can go to whatever country they want to. Okay, that's rewatchability for this week. Thanks for listening. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, where you can go and subscribe and rate us and review us. We're also on any of the other podcatcher things that you listen to, Spotify, Stitcher, if that's still a thing. If you want to communicate with us, we're on Twitter at Rewatchability, or we're on Facebook. We're also on Instagram at Rewatchability. And if you'd like to become a Patreon, go to patreon.com/rewatchability, and you can give us some money there. And that's what we got. I don't know, what do we say to end this thing?
Beware the moon.
Yeah, I'm scared.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.